Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Raymond from Seattle, and I want to talk a little bit about what Joe Tish touched on, which is the unification in our life of our job, our home, and our church. We recently, up in Seattle, had our first ever open house. And we waited quite a few years. I think we've been there, well, since 92, whatever that is, many years. And we finally had the courage to do an open house. And we're quite grateful that the response was a very welcome and warm one, both from intentional communities and the local area as well. But as Joe Tish said, the spreading of like wildfire has not exactly happened yet. Now, a couple of comments, because in my experience in talking to other communities, I realize that our vocabulary, it'll be helpful for us to understand what we're really talking about in a broad sense, as well as in relating as having an impact on this community's movement. For you see, spiritual communities, or religious communities as they're usually called, though not by us, are generally discounted in the community's movement as being somewhat irrelevant because of their focus on spirituality and less so on the, you might say, the humanistic aspects of the community's lifestyle. But you know, when you read Yogananda, when you read Master's description of communities in his autobiography and other writings, he talks about high ideals and simplicity of life. He didn't overtly or specifically, although his whole life was dedicated to self-realization, but in his comments on communities, he painted for us a very broad picture. Similarly, I know also I was talking at a class I did and enthusiastically about our upcoming open house, and someone came up to me afterwards and said, well, you know, I live in a house, and that's a kind of community too. And I said, well, of course it's a kind of community, but here we are today celebrating 40 years of an intentional spiritual community. And of course, everything that we talk about in community, how we live and job, work, and so forth, home and church, of course it has application without. I was thinking that in the beginning of Ananda Village in 1969, I doubt even Google could tell us how many communities were established that same year, but I can pretty well guess there aren't very many left to tell the tale. And so if we perhaps err in the direction of a Jewish joke I've heard Davy tell occasionally and I've read that goes something along like this, if I don't butcher it too badly. Somebody, a Jewish person was once wanting to tell a Gentile friend the history of their feasts and so forth. And he said, well, it goes like this, you see. They tried to destroy us. They didn't. Let's eat. And so I hope you'll forgive us for the fact that merely surviving is itself a victory. And it is. We've certainly had our challenges. But survive for what? And that's our topic today. Because it's not, as it might have had a hint of at least, if not more, in the early days of the founding of this World Brotherhood Village, it is not really a turning our back on the world. As Joe Tish talked about, this is an age for bringing spirit to work, spirit into form, into the world. And though there was a touch of that back to the land movement, I found in my conversations with other communitarians that we've matured. There's an understanding that this community's lifestyle acts as a demonstration, a model of how to live in this new age, where your next door neighbor can be from a different culture, a different religion, speak a different language, and so on. And so part of our understanding needs to be that even if amongst us here today, this group, that there not everyone can, in fact, live in a World Brotherhood colony, community. Nonetheless, the example bears great fruit for how we live in daily life. Secondly, I think when I reflected about at our open house, who we were and what our role was in the community's movement, and when our manager, Larry Ryder, did some research in the Northwest and submitted a list of about 40 intentional communities, including co-housing groups, I realized going down the list, by golly, we're the largest one of them all and among the most senior in time, and it hasn't been that many years to boot. And so I realized that we should be a part of this movement. We can be an example to the movement. And when Master talked about our ideals, for us our ideals are summarized in the term self-realization through the practice of Kriya Yoga and as disciples of a great guru. But yet in my conversations with other communitarians, they too, for the most part, are motivated by ideals of one sort or another. And so when he talks about this spreading like wildfire, I at least, and I think probably many of us here too, realize that the form that this will take is not necessarily lots of Ananda communities all over the world, although that'd be perfectly fine with most of us. It's the fact that people will realize the value of coming together to share their ideals and to express those in daily life. You know, I think of the symbol of the bomb. You know, I grew up in the 50s in rather an idealistic, or whatever that term is. I practically have to apologize for having an idyllic childhood by the ocean and this, that, and the other. And really, it was wonderful. But, you know, there we were hiding under our desks because the bomb was going to go off any minute, and this, that, and the other. There was plenty of anxiety, and our parents, for the most part, were busy trying to forget the Depression, forget the war years and Korean War and so on and so forth. But in the symbol of that bomb, which split the atom, in some ways it fragmented our psyche because it fooled us into imagining we had power over matter and that was enough. Jyotish mentioned about the broader trends in our culture and on our planet, and I think we have to be kind to ourselves in saying that we can't really see what those trends are, or can't really judge the culture in which we live from the fact that we live in it. But on the other hand, I, for one, can't help but imagine hundreds of years from now, history will look back on the 20th century especially, and on how far into the 21st, I can't say and prefer not to imagine, that this was a time of great fragmentation of our psyche. And there are alternative lifestyles and people working in science and ecology and sustainability on all forms that are seeking in their own way to rebuild that psyche. And so what I wanted to talk about a little bit, just touch on, was this idea of sustainability. A good friend of mine in Seattle, his name is Christopher Mayer, travels all over the world. He works on concepts and planning of eco-villages in Thailand and Australia and Europe and America. And he's been sharing with me some of his research and his different conferences he goes to, and it's really quite impressive. There are many people doing wonderful things. But I said to him, sustainability, okay. I can understand that in ecological terms, at least to some extent, permaculture and so on. But what about sustainability of our spirit? What about sustainability of our heart? What about sustainability of creativity and joy? After all, a community that gets formed in order to have a wonderful farm, if they can't get along, how wonderful will that farm be and for how long? Not very, and not very likely. And so you might say in the community's movement, we're at that end of the spectrum, which, as Jyotish talks about, represents the new dispensation of spiritual consciousness into this age. And yet this concept will spread increasingly throughout the world. When I talk to high-minded people of whatever persuasion they may be, looking at the circumstances we face around us, people say, without exception, well, yes, these are challenging times for us, but it's a time for us to reorient our priorities. What's sustainability if we go into debt beyond our means? What's sustainability if we can never have a deep and committed relationship or friendship? What's sustainability if we eat at McDonald's all our life and so on? Well, we know what that is. Sustainability, therefore, is something that's within us. And when we have the lifestyle in these communities, which has given so many of us who have been privileged to live this lifestyle of having in one place our job, our church, and our home and families and friends, over the years, it's just grown within me the sensibility. What a sensible way to live. We're not turning our backs on the world. People from these communities travel all over the world. We have friends and other communities. Swamiji, God bless him, has, even in our times of trial, as it were, when it would be so easy, when you're down and out and hurt and struggling, to turn your back on the world and to focus on your getting your home built, for example, as was needed after the fire in 1976. At every crucial turn, he offered to us, by his example, service. And it's not a huge change. It's not a giant shift in any outward term to go from work to service. But if you work in corporate America, and God bless all those good souls who are working in corporate America with high ideals, God bless you all, but when you're working in those venues, you are largely working alone with very little support. For this model of cooperation with our world for a sustainable lifestyle on all levels to really be meaningful and impactful and to be an example, we need tangible examples. And so he has shown us, and I was thinking recently, and you know, many of us are describing Swami's health come back recently as nothing less than a miracle. And we've been so blessed to have his wisdom, his attunement with the great master, Paramahansa Yogananda, to help give birth to these communities. But if we're honest, and we're looking forward into the future, and we have gathered here today a wide range of ages, and many of you will have to carry these ideals on, we're not always going to have. It doesn't make sense, or it isn't safe to rely upon, always having such a leader of wisdom always before us and guiding us. Because the fact is, the truth is, in Dwapara Yuga, and the ideal of self-realization, is that we must needs go inside to find those inner resources, and then only can we recognize them without ourselves. And so we must find those inner resources. He's taught us supportive leadership, which means not to emphasize leadership for its own sake, but how it can support one another, that people are more important than things. I happen to be the person who was the, I suppose, the central figure in a story he tells in the book, The Place Called Ananda. I was on the housing committee for some years, and in the most communities it's generally true that housing, the supply of housing is in short supply, however you put that. And in those days, in the early days, when things were, well, to put a happy face on it, considered temporary dwellings, when it came time to sell one or something to another person, you simply got back what you cost in materials. Later on, when we had to get permits and do things a little more up to snuff for code, a lot more labor was involved, and so labor became an element. Well, in that transition between the temporary dwellings and the more permanent ones, issues arose on how to fairly value things, because in most intentional communities, not driven by market and making money and so forth, we want people who want to live this way to be able to afford it. And so there are natural restraints on how much you can ask for your home. And so at that particular time, not having done this before, some of us were not too pleased about a particular instance in which a member who was moving elsewhere wanted for his home. Well, I'll never forget, and he will never let me forget, having published the story, that there was a higher principle than precedent, and so on, and the higher principle was compassion for one who was leaving the community. And that, of course, in the end, the price that he wanted was not a particularly big deal, even though it may have seemed so for the circumstances that surrounded it at the time. And so learning these lessons on how to get along, learning how to open your home, as all of our communities do, whether we have an open house or visitors to our community, to open your home to guests. He's taught us how to be gracious and how to serve people, and the guest is God. I find increasingly with people coming to our communities, our lifestyle is so fragmented. People rarely sit down in their homes and have a dinner together, rarely use forks and knives, and only those boxes that come from the store, you know, and eat directly out of them. And this way of how to live and how to integrate our private meditations with our public worship, how each feeds the other and so on. I've often told the story when I lived here for many years that I could always tell when my attunement was dwindling, when I'd wake up on a Sunday morning and say, "Ah, I've been with these people all week. Do I need to go to Sunday service?" After a while, even I caught on and realized, yes. Because when I did, of course, I came away inspired. But these lessons are much more difficult. Going to church only on Sunday is not enough to give you the experience and not enough to give anybody else an example. And that's what these communities serve for, is to give an inspiration and a model to many people. And I know I speak for all of us here gathered today and many hundreds of others around the world who are deeply grateful for having had the good karma, the opportunity to live in such a community. But by those who come, whether they live here or not, and help be part of it, the virtual community, it's a great blessing and a great work. Thank you.